Jackie Stewart and Colleen, who manages the book table over here, about an idea they came up with. And so I'm going to give them some time to talk about their idea. And it's basically to put this book, A Matter of Days, which was released just last, what was it, two Sundays ago? I think it was two Sundays ago. But their idea was, wouldn't it be neat to put this into the hand of astronomers, especially teaching astronomers? And the whole point as you read through this book is to recognize that there is actually an assault on astronomy as a profession. In fact, there have been three states, Georgia, Ohio, and I'm trying to think of the third state. Yeah, Kansas. Kansas, Georgia, and Ohio school boards have actually had policies of eliminating astronomy as a required subject. And the reason for that is they felt that that would damage some people's religious beliefs. Therefore, let's just not make that a required subject. And, of course, that fueled quite a response from the scientific community. And, Jackie and Colleen felt, you know, if these astronomers, especially the teaching astronomers, had this book, it could really help them deal with some of these issues that are rising in the church and, quote, threatening their discipline. So Jackie, I think, has a proposal she wants to talk to you about. I'm going to ask her to come forward. We didn't warn you, but I did tell Colleen that I was going to do this. She was one that talked to me and said, you know, we got to talk about this today. And I said, well, you know, Jackie's really the spokesperson here, so so you're on.
Yeah, well, you notice Colleen's look over there. She's safely seated. But, okay. Anyhow, I started to read this book, and I, as you all know by now, since I'm so verbal, I don't have any science background, and I actually was able to understand this. I mean, that's amazing. And so I was talking to Hugh about it, and I got this idea. It must have been from God, because it's a big idea, I think, that we really need to get this book into the hands of astronomers. And I was just talking for just a couple of seconds to Hugh. I said, you know, they probably read a lot of astronomy books, but I bet you they would never read seen anything like this. And Hugh said they probably don't even know that this controversy exists. So I thought, well, how can we do this? How can this class do something about this? And I came up with talking with Colleen, the idea of matching funds. We already have two people that will match funds for every book that's purchased in this class, with the immediate aim, and maybe it could even be a bigger aim, like the astronomers all over the United States, having a copy of this book. So that's about all I'm going to say today. This plan has started already, and maybe next week, when I want to give this time to Hugh to talk, we can talk further about this for a few minutes, give you a week to think about it. If anybody has anything to say right now, you can, but we could just put that off till next week. So, right, that's been brought up, and then I'm very pleased to know that he has certainly picked that up immediately. So, anybody else have an immediate reaction you'd like to? Well, Hugh mentioned there might be as many as 500 to 1,000 in California. Mm-hmm.
But California's got 1/4 of the world's total. Yeah.
The bookstores. I just recently joined the RTB Los Angeles chapter, and Mark is the president of that chapter, and he is the vice president. I mean, Ross is the vice president. There's about 20 people that met yesterday, and we talked about this. Yeah.
I'll take over here.
Okay.
Sure.
Sure. Thanks, Jackie.
You're welcome.
Yeah, one quarter of the world's astronomers are living in California, so just reaching the California astronomers would have a major impact. Moreover, those one quarter tend to be the predominant astronomers within the research community, so you really are reaching the movers and shakers. And of those one quarter, probably half have teaching roles. And the thing I've noticed, just talking to professors who teach, number one, they don't know that they're Christians that like astronomy. They think all Christians hate astronomy. And therefore, I think this book might be a really helpful tool for them to realize not all of us are against them. Moreover, they're hit with questions that they don't know how to answer. Their students come up to them with questions. They don't know where to point them or direct them. And as many atheist professors have pointed out to me, you know, when my students come up to me with this anti-astronomy stuff, how can I talk to them without destroying them? And so they're looking for some tool. Not all atheists are mean-hearted. Some of them are, you know, just really need to know something that they don't know. And to have a tool that they could give to their students that could help them understand the value of astronomy and see this controversy with different perspectives. A number of astronomers approached me and said, you know, they'd like to consider this as a supplemental text. And so one thing we're thinking about is that when we send them a copy, we'll slip a coupon in here that if they wanted to use this as a book they would give out to their students, they could do that. So that's kind of the strategy. And frankly, I never thought of it at all until Jackie. So Jackie really deserves the credit. This did not come from Reasons to Believe. But when Jackie shared it with me, I said, you know, that's a great idea because, you know, that's where my heart really bleeds is just how these astronomers look upon the Christian community as an enemy that's out to get them, and, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. Yes?
Well, I was wondering, most of the exposure is just to astronomy is younger than the age, and most astronomers think it is.
Yeah, that's where it comes from, but it's not just young Earth creationists. There's a number of Christians who take the perspective we don't want to expose our students to controversy, and they look at astronomy as a very controversial subject, so even though they're not young Earth, they say, let's not teach it. And that's exactly what happened in these three states. They said, you know, this is controversial for the students and for the parents of the students, so we simply will not require the teaching of astronomy in the public school classroom.
What are some specific young Earthers who suggest?
Well, what young Earth creationists have figured out is any astronomical object more distant than Pluto is a threat to their paradigm. And therefore, what they've done is they said, I've overstated my case. They're not saying that we should eliminate astronomy from the public education curriculum. They're saying we should eliminate astronomy that's beyond Pluto. So, you know, we could talk about the sun, you could talk about the moon and the earth, but you can't talk about stars or galaxies. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not as bad as what I said originally, but, you know, to me there's a lot of astronomy beyond Pluto. You know, my specialty was extragalactic astronomy, so I say you got to at least get past the galaxy. But it is true that any object more distant than Pluto would, you know, be a serious threat to that young Earth paradigm. And because it is a threat to them, Christians who are not young Earth just say this is too hot to handle. By the way, I'm going to be speaking in churches next week, and one thing I'd ask you to pray for is how many churches in America have stopped teaching on Genesis because it's a hot potato. And yet I would argue that Genesis is a critical book of the Bible for understanding the theology of salvation. You know, that's where it all begins. So to ignore Genesis, I think, is a mistake. But it's happening, you know, within theology departments. Since this is controversial, let's avoid it. And by the way, I've, you know, been a pastor at this church for, well, 30 years now. And the thing I've noticed is that when you're on a board or a committee or you're a pastor, it's really tempting just to let the controversy go by the way. You know, let's avoid it and focus on stuff that's non-controversial. But I can tell you from my 30 years of experience in the pastoral role, if you ignore controversies, they get worse. just like with your kids, right? If you get into a controversy with your kids and you try to ignore it, or they try to ignore it, it just festers and it gets worse. Rather, we need to practice what you see in 2 Corinthians 5:20. We are ambassadors for Christ. And what's an ambassador's call? To make peace where there's hostility, to make peace where there's controversy. And that's really the tone of this book. The tone of this book is to bring peace and resolution to an issue that's been controversial and full of hostility. And what we're trying to do is say, you know, maybe we could mobilize the efforts of astronomers to help. And of astronomers, by the way, I think this controversy could disappear virtually overnight if more astronomers would attend church. Not many of us attend church, but if we could start filling up the church with astronomers, and maybe that will be the outcome of what Jackie and Colleen are doing, is we're going to see more astronomers attending church. And that wouldn't be a bad thing, at least not from my perspective. Yes. Yeah, where you see that barge predominantly is within the intelligent design community. Yeah, so it was the intelligent design grassroots political efforts in Ohio, Kansas, and Georgia that made that move. And the whole idea is that they want Christians to unite under a common tent. And since they can't unite under astronomy or radiometric dating, that's the other discipline that they don't want to have taught in the public education arena. I say, since those disciplines are controversial, we're just not going to. And by the way, they're not saying we're going to eliminate that as a discipline. What they are saying is we're simply going to make it optional. But hey, you know what teachers are like? If you've got optional material in your curriculum, are you going to teach it? You've got enough to do. You're going to teach to the exams. And so there really is not much motivation for a public school teacher to teach material that is optional. Some will, but most will be motivated by, you know, just the need to successfully prepare their students for the test. So that's kind of the background in that situation. By the way, I am going to Georgia tomorrow, and I'm going to be speaking at Georgia Tech and a church in Georgia, and this issue is bound to come up. It's not my talk, but I know it's going to come up in the Q&A time, so I appreciate your prayers. And then following that, I'm going to be going to a conference on intelligent design in North Carolina. And it's the first intelligent design conference I've been involved in which they brought in young Earth and older speakers that are kind of, you know, in the heart of this controversy. And I remember talking to the pastor saying, do you really want to do this? This is one way to really flame the controversy. And he says, well, we've asked everybody not to say bad things about one another. And I said, well, I appreciate your prayers that the pastor's prayer request would be honored. That's the one prayer I ask that for all of you. And then I'm going to finish up my trip that, I'm going to be at the Christian Booksellers Convention. Our publishers asked us to be there since we've got 3 books coming out. So I'm going to represent the Reasons to Believe team. And there'll be a number of radio interviews, but it's all going to finish off with a set of television episodes on the John Ankerberg Show. And I'm going to be doing 6 episodes with Walt Kaiser. And you can pray about that, too, because what happened is John Ankerberg did 9 episodes with Ken Samples, Fuzz Rana, and me on the evidence for God and the hard sciences and the origin of life, and then we kind of went through the Genesis question. And the result was that the young Earth creationist community really went ballistic in attacking John Ankerberg. But John doesn't have the personality that I have. You go after him, he tends to go after you. So John said, let's do 6 shows. And he's bringing Walt Kaiser. Walt Kaiser is probably the theological heavyweight since the passing of Gleason Archer. I don't know anyone who's got more academic credibility on the Old Testament exegesis than Walt Kaiser. So the two of us are going to do 6 episodes. And basically, we're going to take people through the heart of this book. And it's something I did on the Trinity Evangelical Divinity School campus back in 1991. And Walter was there and said, yeah, let's do it again, but we're going to do it in front of cameras. But I want you to pray that we'd have the right spirit You know, 1 Peter 3:15, give an answer for the hope within you, give an answer for the resolution of controversy, but with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And pray that all three of us would be able to do that. Yes. Yes, but probably the longest trip. It's going to be 9 days, and I haven't done a 9-day trip in about 8 years. So, yeah, I'll try to give you a good report on what's going on there. But you know, in terms of the scientific discovery that I want to talk about today, it actually ties right in with our text in Job. But it made the front cover of this week's Nature. And it's the first time I've noticed that glaciers or icebergs have made the cover of Nature. What they're talking about is, this has been going on for about 5 years. A European consortium decided that they were going to dig the deepest borehole through ice that's ever been done. And you know, in terms of Greenland, that's the one I talk about in this book. They did two cores on Greenland, separated by 30 miles from one another, and they drilled through about 120,000 annual ice layers. And I report on it in this book because of the fact that you've got two boreholes far enough apart and you see exactly the same data stream as you go down a 120,000-year record. There's one that's been done in Antarctica that drills through 350,000 years of ice. And then the most famous has been the Vostok core, which goes through 420,000 years of ice. But the long-awaited drill hole by this European group called EPICA, or EPICA, this is not yet finished. Their plan was to drill through 1 million years of ice. And so what they've got reported here in this journal Nature is the first 740,000 years of that record. And they also close the paper off saying we're not too sure how successful we're going to be with the remaining 200,000 years. Because the thing with ice is that it gets heavy after a while. And that weight raises the temperature. And what they've discovered is at the very base of the ice record, that ice is melting. And so they're very carefully drilling through that semi-melting ice in order not to disturb it and get a faithful record of the last 200,000 years. Well, what they said is, let's publish the 740,000 years, because it's going to be a few more years before they can do the rest of it. And so this is the deepest borehole ever done. And what's, I think, encouraging in terms of resolving this young Earth, old Earth thing is that all the boreholes are consistent. And you really can see that these are annual layers, because these annual layers actually show you historically established events. For example, every time a major volcano erupts, it puts down an ash layer, and that ash layer will be picked up in these boreholes. And so you can see the Vesuvius eruption, you can see Krakatoa, and you can actually count the number of layers there and say, yeah, these really do represent years. But what really got people excited about this is, you know, they don't know nothing about the young Earth, old Earth issue, but they're really into cycles. And, you know, there are three things that drive climatic cycles. There's the precession of the Earth's rotation. Let me get a planet Earth out of here. Okay, there's a 26,000-year cycle driven by precession. And what precession is that, let me get it oriented right, you've got the planet rotating like this, but it's like a spinning top in that this rotation axis goes through a wobble of about 26,000 years. Still stays at 23.5 degrees, but it does this circular path, and this is why, for example, the Polaris is the North Star today, but 13,000 years from now, Vega will be the North Star because of this wobble that takes place. And this does drive a climatic cycle. Why? Because with it tilted like this, what you're going to discover is that during the winter, the planet is actually closest to the sun during the northern winter. And during the northern summer, the planet is most distant from the sun. You know, the sun actually has a slightly eccentric orbit. so it's a little bit elliptical. And at one point in the year, we're a little closer to the sun than another part of the year. Well, we're closest to the sun in the wintertime and farthest away in the summer. And that does affect our climate. And what it actually does is, given where that precession is right now, that means that we who live in the northern hemisphere have warmer winters and cooler summers, and that actually makes it possible for us to sustain a large high-tech population. Why? Because as you look at this planet, almost all the land mass is above the equator. There's not much on the south part. And the way you look at the south part, you realize that only Antarctica is at an extreme southern latitude, because the greater the latitude, the greater the climatic effect. So even when you look at the south part of the planet, you notice that most of the land mass is up towards the equator. You've got that little thin part of South America, but it's only a couple hundred thousand square miles. It's as high latitude. Then you get into Antarctica. All the rest of the continental land mass gets the benefit of this wobble. Now, what does that mean? It means 13,000 years from now, it's going to be the other way around. But that's 13,000 years from now. And, one of the things I write about in this book is how, God designed things in such a way that we'd be reaching the peak of technology and civilization and population just when the wobble is just right. Okay, and that is something that's commented on in here in Nature, how it seems like these different orbital factors are all lining up to give us the most benign climate possible for human civilization today. And they say, how coincidental. We would argue this isn't a coincidence, it's something designed by God. Okay, there's two other cycles. One cycle is the eccentricity. As I mentioned, the Earth has a slightly elliptical orbit around the Sun, but it varies with respect to time. Sometimes our orbit is more eccentric than other times, and that cycle is 41,000 years. So it goes through that kind of, it's 100,000 years. There's a 100,000-year period for the eccentricity. And finally, there's something called the obliquity. And you say, well, what's that? Here's the Earth going around the Sun. And the obliquity is how much the Earth's orbit is tilted in terms of an angle relative to the plane of the solar system. And it's only tilted by a very tiny amount, but it varies a little bit, and it varies over a 41,000-year cycle. And what these geophysicists discovered in drilling through 740,000 annual layers is that for the last half million years, we've been experiencing a 100,000 kilo-year cycle in terms of the predominant climatic fluctuations. Whereas for the half million years previous to that, we see that it's dominated by a 41,000 year cycle. And there again, that's what you'd really like if you want to have human beings under benign conditions for a long period of time. You want us to be in that part of the cycle where the period between one peak in the climate and next peak in the climate is long rather than short. And so three possible cycles. There's three things, as the Earth goes around the Sun. There are three different climatic cycles you can get over the course of several billion years. Parts of the Earth's orbit, you'll be getting a 26,000-year cycle. Other parts, you'll be getting a 41,000-year cycle. Other parts, you'll get a 100,000-year cycle. We happen to be living in the history of the solar system where we're getting a 100,000-year cycle, which means that you're going to get things like ice ages happening about once every 100,000 years rather than once every 41,000 years. And indeed, it's been a while since we have had an ice age, and probably won't get another ice age for quite a while, as long as you don't mess up global warming and things like that by too great a degree. And so that's really the theme of this article, is all this neat design we're finding that shows us that we human beings are living under the most benign conditions possible given the history of the orbital fluctuations of the Earth as it goes about the Sun and as it's influenced by the Moon. Yes. Well, the usual approach of young Earth creationists is to hope that nobody brings it up. because you're right, it's utterly devastating to their paradigm. And one reason why I brought this up today is it's also devastating to their flood theology. You know, their belief is that there was this massive flood at the time of Noah that covered the whole planet, inundated all the mountains. If that were really the case, it would show up in these ice cores. It doesn't show up. There's nothing unusual at the time of Noah. Therefore, there couldn't have been a global flood. There could have been a local flood that wiped out all humanity, what I would call a universal flood. And that's really what we've been talking about in this book. The Bible teaches a universal flood, one that wiped out all humanity. It does not teach a global flood. No need for a global flood unless human beings had actually occupied all the continental land masses. And it's quite clear from the Bible that had not yet happened. Global occupation did not take place until after the time of Nimrod and of Babylon, the Tower of Babel. And therefore, God wouldn't have to go to that extent. And we can look at both the Greenland ice cores and the Antarctic ice cores and see that that's not the case. I mean, one of two things would happen. You'd get a really thick ice layer, or you would get a lot of melting. If you're going to say warm water covered Antarctic, then you would see evidence for melting. And also that ice traps the atmosphere. And that's another thing that these scientists are interested in. They go into these ice layers and they measure what the atmosphere was like. And so they can see variations in carbon dioxide and oxygen. And that tells them a lot about what kind of life would exist and what the biomass of the planet would have been. And they can see a cycle in biomass. They also trap a lot of carbonaceous material. And that also enables them to get a measurement on what kind of microscopic life forms are predominant on the planet at that time. But a global flood would have affected all those measurements, and we don't see that. Yes, Jim?
How deep are we going in these boreholes? How many feet or miles?
Well, so far they've gotten down to almost 3 kilometers. So that's about a 2-mile depth, and they got about 200 more kilometers to go. And you say, how come you get so much in 200? Well, keep in mind, with the weight of the ice, the layers are going to get thinner towards the bottom. So even though they only got 200 more meters to go, that does cover an estimated 200,000 years. Whereas at the top, the layers would be thicker because there's not as much weight pressing down on them. Yes? Well, a big enough meteoritic event that could have shown up in this record occurred about 2 million years ago. And so this doesn't go deep enough to pick up a significant extraterrestrial collision event. That thing that took place in Arizona 10,000 years ago, that won't kick up enough dust to show up in the record. But it will pick up every major volcano. And it does pick up all the major volcanic eruptions that are recorded in human history. And so that's the evidence you could go to prove that these are really annual layers. You know, the more serious younger creationists that are confronted with this will try to claim that the layers are not annual layers. They will say, well, this is not really a record of what's going on. You can see them build up every year, and the fact that you can see in the layers evidence for recorded historical events. So, for example, you can see this volcanic dust layer that matches the volcanic dust that we see around Vesuvius. And we've got a good date, thanks to the Romans, for the eruption of Vesuvius. And so you can count down the layers and see if you get the same date as what the historical records show, and it's bang on to the very year. Also, there's carbonaceous material in these ice layers that can be carbon-14 dated. Your younger creations try to claim that carbon-14 is not reliable. Well, you can use these ice layers to say, oh, yes, it is, because we're getting the same date from carbon-14 that we do from counting the layers and from looking at the historical records of past volcanic eruptions. Now, there is evidence for volcanic eruptions that predate human history, but those are things you can't use to calibrate the annual layers, but you know, if everything's annual, down throughout recorded history, then surely the extrapolation is valid beyond human history. Yes. We've not done a movie review the day after tomorrow. I'm not sure that we will. Well,
I mean, firstly, I think it needs to be done because it's obviously, I mean, it's fortunate this movie was so absurd that even my friends that are into global warming come away, came with the movie saying,
well, you know, my son saw the movie. I haven't seen the movie myself, but their response is, what the producers did is they took every imaginable disaster, wrapped it up into like a one-year scenario, so they could show people all these 7 days, so they could show people all these cool effects. And they said, we just ignored the storyline and we enjoyed the special effects. And I think they're probably right. The producer just wanted some really cool special effects, and so concocted a story where he could bring in every imaginable disaster into a one-week period. But I know some Christians who have said, you know, isn't that the tribulation that we're going to see mentioned in Revelation? But I think this one actually outdid the book of Revelation, according to my son. Actually threw in more disasters. I don't think hundreds of tornadoes will ever rip through L.A. In fact, if you want me to make a long-term prediction, it'd be this. As history continues unfolding, we're going to see the number of tornadoes gradually decrease and the hurricanes gradually decrease. Why? Because the planet is slowing down its rotation rate. As it rotates more and more, when it rotates 25 hours a day, we probably will not have any tornadoes. And hurricanes will be really rare when it's rotating only 25 hours a day. But that's one of the disasters they didn't bring into this movie. I asked if my sons did talk about what would happen if the planet started slowing down. You know, the really big disaster is the planet starts to slow down, it's going to get really hot at 2 p.m. and really cold at 2 a.m. You want a fast rotation rate to make sure you don't have too great a day and night temperature difference. So when it gets to be 25 hours a day, it's going to be really unbearable for people without air conditioning and central heating. And if you go outside, well, you're out of luck. You know, you say, how much longer do we have to wait for that to happen? The good news is that's not going to happen for about under 10 million years. So you don't have to make any adjustments to your investment portfolio for a while. Yes. That's a tough question you're throwing me. Do they have any respected scientists on their staff? It depends who you mean respected by whom. But for example, I once had a private luncheon with Henry Morris, the past president of the Institute for Creation Research. And, you know, I was commenting that we didn't really appreciate that fact that he kept putting into his articles and books that our theology was really bad. And he said, well, how about if you do this? We'll stop saying that you guys are bad in your theology. We'll stop saying that we're bad in our science. And, you know, I'm kind of stuck on that one because I don't agree that their science is good. I don't think any scientist outside of the community would acknowledge that it's good. And I did say that I'd be willing to state that their science was no worse than what's promoted by the Flat Earth Society. That didn't satisfy him much. On the other hand, he says, Hugh, I can understand why you'd have to say that. If you're coming from an old Earth perspective, of course you'd have to say something like that. So he wasn't really offended by the comment. But, I mean, that's really the situation you're in. And the scholars I do respect within the young Earth community are the ones that admit that they do not have an exegetical case, a biblical case for their position, or a scientific case. They have a philosophical case. I'll grant that they have a philosophical case. But when they try to claim that they have a scientific case, well, I don't think you've got a scientific case unless people who disagree with your philosophical perspective are willing to admit that your science is of good quality. You know, and that's something we're able to engender for our Origins of Life book. People who disagreed with our theological perspective were nonetheless willing to endorse that the science was good quality. And that's really the standard I think you have to come up with. Someone outside of your narrow ideological perspective must recognize that the theology is decent and the science is decent. And it doesn't bother me that younger creationists think we have terrible theology. there are lots of people who take a different theological perspective than we do that still acknowledge that we have a good theological perspective. Matter of fact, I think one of the most encouraging things that happened to me was during that debate with Kent Hovind, that television debate, and the DVD is over there on the table. A Young Earth Creationist Seminary professor came to the microphone and said, "You know, I disagree with you, Kent Hovind. I think Hugh Ross's theological analysis of Genesis 1 is of high quality." So there's an example where we got a good endorsement from a Young Earth Creationist. That was Daniel Janosik. Right, right. You know, and he's a Hebrew Old Testament exegete. But he's also not an ideologue. He told me privately, "Look, if the evidence keeps accumulating like this, then I will no longer be a Young Earth Creationist." So that's the difference. Okay, can we move on and start talking about Job? Or do we have any more questions? Okay, let's talk. Yeah.
The European Space Agency's X-ray monitoring satellites are on the telescope. Things like the space and system arguments about the amount of matter, dark matter.
Well, if you caught our Tuesday broadcast of Creation Update, what we did talk about was the Chandra X-ray telescope's team's measurements of the dark energy term. And, you know, thanks to NASA and the Europeans, we now have four telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope. Hubble is the premier space telescope for visible ultraviolet, and we have one for gamma rays. One for infrared, and then the Chandra telescope is the Hubble equivalent for X-rays. But that Hubble, or that Chandra telescope, was used to measure the X-ray profile around very large, what they call dynamically relaxed clusters of galaxies. Now, the large thing you probably can figure out. Dynamically relaxed means that the galaxies moving with respect to one another, you know, as they bump into one another gravitationally, if you wait long enough, that velocity movement with respect to one another, gravitational bumping, pulling and tugging, will get down to what they call a randomized velocity profile. And when it reaches a randomized velocity profile, we look at that and say that's dynamically relaxed. By the way, that's an argument I put in this book for why the universe must be old, because we see all these dynamically relaxed clusters everywhere, star clusters and galaxy clusters. But it turns out that large clusters of galaxies that are dynamically relaxed all have the same X-ray profile. So you can look at these large galaxy clusters all over the universe, and that will tell you how fast the universe is expanding. Because you can measure the redshift, and that will tell you the distance and the speed with which it's moving away from you, and then you've got the brightness of the thing, and therefore this becomes a measure for determining how gravity influences the expansion of the universe, and how the dark energy term influences the expansion of the universe. Now, I'll give you the numbers they came up with. It was that the dark energy accounted for 76% of the total density of the universe, plus or minus 4%. That compares with the WMAP based on cosmic background radiation, which said 73%, plus or minus 2%. So it got the same answer. Therefore, there is no discrepancy. In fact, I've got a list here. We mentioned this in Creation Update. A year ago, we had only two tools for measuring the dark energy density of the universe: the WMAP, cosmic background radiation, and type 1a supernova. Now, thanks to discoveries, and all of them were published in the last 2 weeks. This is why we made a big deal about it in Creation Update. 2 week window, all this stuff got published. We now have 7 independent tools for detecting dark energy, X-rays being one of them. All 7 give the same answer. You're within the range of the error bars, namely somewhere between 70 and 80%. Of the total density of the universe is in the form of dark energy. Now, the reason we made such a big deal about it in Creation Update, it's showing us that this dark energy term is not going to go away. In fact, I'm going to be talking about dark energy at Georgia Tech. And the reason for it is there's been these papers that have been published. I got some in my briefcase. One is titled The Disturbing Implications of a Dark Energy Cosmic Term. And the point is this: if the dark energy term is real, then there must be a supernatural being that has fine-tuned the universe to better than one part in 10 to the 120th. That being the case, that supreme creative entity must be personal, must be powerful, creative, intelligent, and knowledgeable to agree that far transcends anything we human beings can manifest. But this one paper I got said this is so utterly disturbing, the dark energy term must be wrong. The astronomers must be wrong in their discovery of the dark energy term, because it would force us to accept this, what they called a causal agent, external causal agent that performs miracles for reasons of his own. So since we can't accept that, this term's got to be wrong. But hey, we now have 7 independent tools for showing us that it's not going to go away. We really do live in a dark energy universe, dark energy dominated universe. And therefore, we really do have to accept the fact that the universe was designed and built by a transcendent causal agent performing miracles for reasons of his own. And those reasons are he wanted a universe with human beings in it. So, let's get on into Job. All right. Job 38, as we've been discussing these last few weeks, what we see here in Job 38 is a parallel of the 6 creation days of Genesis chapter 1. Last week we made it through creation day 1, and that's verses 4 through 9, 12 to 14, and 19 to 21. Okay, today I'd like to look at creation day 2. Now, as I mentioned last week, you cannot expect these poetic creation accounts to be strictly chronological like Genesis 1 is. Genesis 1 is set up as prose. So you got a paragraph that deals with creation day 1, then one deals with creation day 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Job 38, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8 all reflect on Genesis chapter 1, but they do it with poetry, and with poetry, the chronology jumps around. And so we're going to see that different paragraphs of Job 38 might deal with 2 or 3 different days, and you have to kind of pull it all together. Well, I'm going to do for you what I did last week. I'm going to read to you the account for the second creation day in Genesis 1, then we'll look at the parallel verses that we see in Job 38, and try to pick up the details in Job 38 that are not mentioned in Genesis 1. And the principle here is Genesis 1 doesn't give us all the details. If we go to the other creation accounts, this is going to help us to settle all the fights and controversies that Christians love to express over creation theology. So Job 38 can be a great tool for bringing peace and resolution. Creation Day 2, starting in verse 6. Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky, and there was evening, and there was morning the second day. You know, a friend of our ministry, Robert Newman, wrote an entire theology thesis just on these two verses. And I haven't got time this morning to go into all the details of what he said in that thesis, but basically he was making the point that the Genesis 1 is talking about God supernaturally setting up a water cycle to provide water for life on the land as well as in the oceans that would allow for a very large biomass and biodiversity. Now, it doesn't say that in Genesis 1, but if you go to the parallel accounts, and that's what Robert Newman did in his thesis, he went to places like Job 38 and Psalm 104 and said, this is why we can securely conclude that this indeed is talking about God setting up this water cycle. And indeed, the reason why he did this for his thesis, there's been a lot of controversy in the Christian community on what the text means by the statement in Genesis 1, verses 6 and 7. But what we see here in Job 38 starts off in verses 4 through 9, which also reflects on creation day 1. So this is where the poetry becomes a little bit challenging. It's addressing 2 creation days in the same text. Last week we talked about how it reflected on the first creation day. today, let's look at it from the standpoint of the second creation day. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Sure do you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footing set? Or who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who shut up the sea behind the doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? It's really verses 8 and 9 that really tell you that this is paralleling the creation day too. In a sense, because verses 8 and 9 are also addressing creation day 3. So 4 through 7, creation day 1 and 2, which actually goes all the way down to verse 9, but creation day 3 starts in verse 8, and it moves down through to verse 11. But we pick up more details in verse 22. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm, to water a land where no man lives, a desert with no one in it, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass? Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens when the waters come hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Now this is addressing both creation day and creation three. You say, well, you know, this is really getting difficult, the fact that the text is mixing up these days, but also gives us an advantage. Because creation day 2 in Genesis 1 is talking about that era before the continents and islands appeared, its discussion of the waters above and the waters below is limited to that context only. Job 38 doesn't have that restriction. It tells us about this water cycle in the context of creation days 2 and 3. In fact, we're going to pick it up later where it talks about in the context of creation days 5 and 6. This allows God in Job 38 to say a lot more about the scientific details of the water cycle than would have been possible in Genesis 1. So that's why we have all these poetic creation texts to complement the prose that we see in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. There really are things you can say with poetry that you can't say with prose. And therefore we get a lot more details that this water cycle that God set up on creation day 2 really had its fulfillment in terms of God's purpose in the events of creation day 3 and following. So, you know, if you're around in creation day 2, you might say, well, why did God set up this water cycle? Don't need a water cycle. The waters are covering the whole face of the earth. Now, why all this useless rain? But what we see here in Job 38, it's not useless in the context of what's going to happen after creation day 2. And therefore, we get all these details of exactly what it took and why we look at the events of creation day 2 and say that's a divine miracle. It's not so great a miracle just to get rain coming down from the sky, but to get rain coming down from the sky in such a way that it's going to permit an abundance of life to proliferate on the future continental land masses, that is a far superior miracle. And this is something we talked about in Job 36 and 37, another advantage of poetry. Notice what we see in verse 22. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow or seen the storehouses of the hail, which are reserved for times of trouble? What is the way to the place where lightning is dispersed? And he talks about the east winds. Now, if you've been reading the discourse of Job, you realize that's already been discussed in great detail by Elihu's discourse over an entire chapter and a half. And therefore, God, when he brings this subject up, doesn't have to give as much detail because he says, look, this is something you've already discussed, you already understood. I inspired my servant Elihu to give you all these details about the lightning. But we stand 35 centuries later and we look at this and say, isn't it amazing that God inspired Elihu to talk all this detail about lightning and hail when they had no idea at that time how critical the design of lightning is to make sure that you get adequate nitrogen fixation and the rain coming down from the sky so that you get an abundance of the kind of plants that are necessary for the support of human beings and human civilization. Elihu talks about it. The Lord brings it up in Job 38, but not until the 20th century did we have a clue how critical lightning was. But look at all the detail about lightning in Job 36 and 37. And that's why it shows up here in Job's or in the Lord's discussion addressed to these five men. And he's basically saying, you really don't know what I know in terms of what I did to make this all work, so that I could use this to father the drops of dew, to make sure there was ice, something we talked about in Job 36 and 37. It's not just a water cycle bringing raindrops down from the sky. It's a water cycle that brings the just right balance of snow, hail, and the formation of ice, as well as the liquid water and the vapor. And that's where we can look at planet Earth today and see the amazing design in the water cycle to ensure we get water in all the right forms so that we can sustain life in great abundance all year round. We live in a state where that's critical. We don't get much rainfall here in this state. Most of the rainfall we get comes down as snow, and some of that snow compactifies into ice, and then it comes off the mountains and provides us with an abundant supply of water all year round. Well, at least abundant until we get 35 million people living here in California. But the whole point is, God designed mountains here in California, and he designed the El Nino cycle and so forth to make sure that, you know, about every 11 years we get a really heavy snowpack, and that snowpack keeps us going for quite a while. And every winter, you know, isn't it great that the precipitation here in California is predominantly in the wintertime? What if it was predominantly in the summertime? And the point that God is making here in Job is the whole planet's been designed this way to make sure that everything is optimized for the benefit of life. Okay, then finally, verses 34 to 38. Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, here we are? Who endowed the heart with wisdom, or gave understanding to the mind? Who is the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? And again, this is all stuff that's been discussed in some detail in Job 36 and 37. The Lord here is taking advantage of this previous discussion to alert them to what has already been inspired through Job and Elihu in the previous dialogues in this book. But again, from our 20th and 21st century perspective, we can look back on all this and say it's not just that God has designed the lightning. He's made sure the lightning is where it needs to be. You know, certain parts of the planet need more lightning, other parts of the planet. We don't get that much lightning here. Get a lot more on the East Coast. But the East Coast doesn't have the elevation profile or the rain pattern that California does. And this really explains why it's different in different parts. And he says, you know, you're sitting here, and by the way, as we mentioned last time, part of what's going on here in Job 38 and to a greater degree in Job 39, 40, and 41, God is really giving a creation quiz to these five men, saying, you've been talking about creation for 37 chapters. Now let me give you a little quiz. Let's see how well you do in the quiz. And they don't do very well in the quiz, and Job admits that he failed the test. But what I find quite incredible is that 35 centuries later, we don't do a whole lot better than these five gentlemen. We know a little more than they know, but we still are not able to address God's question. All right, figure out the water cycle. I remember when I was growing up as a teenager, atmospheric physicists had the goal that by the end of the 20th century, they'd have total control over the weather. Some of you are old enough to remember that boast, okay? Remember physicists actually saying, come the 21st century, we're going to have complete control over the weather. Well, I think God's got something to say about that in Job 38. This is a lot more challenging than you might realize. And that statement goes just as much for us today as it did for Job and his four friends. Okay, that's creation day two. Let me move on into creation day three. Creation day three starts, and by the way, as we move into the other creation accounts, we're going to see that they pick up the theme again. And so some of the conclusions I've been drawing for you here are not just in the context of Job 38. Psalm 104 also addresses creation days 1 and 2. And this is something Robert Newman brought up in his thesis, is that, you know, okay, Job 38 seems to give us a particular interpretation of Genesis 1. We can test that by going to Psalm 104 to see if that's supported. by going to Proverbs 8 to see if it's supported. And in the case of the creation day 3, we got another creation psalm we can go to, Psalm 33. So, and also the New Testament deals with it. There's a hand over here. Yes. Well, if you go to Revelation chapter 1, you'll see that it defines stars as a symbol definition. I think it's the last verse of Revelation 1. It actually says the stars are the angels. And so that's the clue that there may be other places in the Bible where the term stars doesn't refer to these burning globes of gas, but actually refers to angels themselves. Right. Well, I mean, you're making a good point that this text indicates that there is at least two strata of angels. And, you know, depending who you read, there may be more than two strata of angels. But the Bible talks at least about four. There's the archangels, the seraphim, the cherubim, and then the angels. And maybe there's more categories. But yeah, there are higher orders of angels compared to the bulk number of the angels. And what exactly are the distinctions between the archangels, the cherubim, the seraphim, and the rest of the angels is somewhat indeterminate. Good places to go for that would be the book of Revelation and the book of Ezekiel that talks about these different categories of angels. And the archangels certainly are the most powerful of the angels. And the seraphim and cherubim play a role in revealing Christ to the rest of creation, particular roles. And again, a good place to go would be Ezekiel and Revelation to bring that up. But this may be a reference to that. The morning stars, astronomically speaking, are referring to Venus and Mercury. And at the time that this was written, that was in the culture of the ancient civilizations, that the Venus and Mercury were the bright morning stars. They're called the bright morning stars because both of these planets are much brighter when seen in the morning than when seen in the evening. You know, Venus is now transitioned into a morning star. And you'll see that it's going to become quite a bit brighter than when you were seeing it in the evening. And it gets about six times brighter in the morning than it does in the evening. And also, Venus is the brightest object in the sky when it's a morning star besides the sun and the moon. So evidently, if you want to follow through with your analysis, these morning stars would have to be the brightest of the angels because they would be the brightest of the objects that people looking up at the sky would call stars. Keep in mind, the ancients referred to both the planets and the stars as stars. But Revelation 1 tells us that they are, that it's a symbol for angels. And I think that fits here because it's clearly telling us that these are persons. These are not things like Sirius and the sun. They sing together. They shout for joy. They're witnessing God laying the foundations of the earth. And as I mentioned, I think 2 weeks ago when we discussed this, this is the only verse in the Bible that talks about angels in terms of when they first existed. This is telling us that they would certainly have been around since God laid the foundations of the earth. So they must have been created previous to 4 billion years ago. Okay, creation day 3. It starts off in verse 8. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. Now that's mixing creation days 1, 2, and 3. Even mixing the events before creation day 1. The clouds covering the planet with darkness would be a reference to Genesis 1, 2. How the Spirit of God was brooding over the surface of the waters and there was darkness on the face of the deep. And so this text would tell you it's dark because, not for the lack of light, but because the clouds formed this thick, opaque blanket. But verse 10 says, when I fixed limits for it, and there it's referring to the sea, the oceans. The Bible doesn't make a distinction between oceans and seas. When you see the word sea, it's referring to the oceans. when I fixed limits for the ocean, set its doors and bars in place, when I said, this far you may come and no farther, here is where your proud waves halt. And so the point here is in the context of creation day three, God separated the land masses from the oceans, and that's a permanent thing that God did. And on that basis, you could conclude that the flood of Genesis cannot be global in extent. This text tells us that God set up these barriers and said, here is where your proud waves halt. Psalm 104 makes it clear that this indeed is something that's permanent from creation day to forward, where it says, but at your rebuke the waters fled. Psalm 104 verse 7, at the sound of your thunder they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains, they went down into the valleys to the place you assigned for them. You set a boundary they cannot cross. Never again will they cover the earth. And so there is a very explicit statement in the context of creation day three that the waters that God had separated could never again cover the whole face of the earth. And some other places you can go to see this discussed. Psalm 33, by the word of the Lord, verse 6, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry hosts by the breath of his mouth. I often use this verse when I'm talking to scientists and engineers. You want to know how the universe was made? It wasn't made by some quantum fluctuation of the space-time foam. It wasn't a multiverse. This is, it was made by the word of God, something that's beyond matter, energy, space, and time. This is where it refers to creation day 3, verse 7. He gathers the waters of the sea into jars. He puts the deep into storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the people of the world revere him. For he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. Then it makes a whole point throughout the rest of this verse about how we can count on God standing firm. And so scholars analyzing this, is this too supports the fact that the waters cannot cover the whole face of the earth, because the rest of the psalm is talking about how much we can count upon, the Lord and his plan standing firm forever. Then you can go to Proverbs chapter 8. Proverbs chapter 8. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, before his deeds of old, verse 22. I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled into place, before the hills I was given birth, before he made the earth or its fields or any of the dust of the world, I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon of the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and set security at the fountains of the deep. You know, this is really difficult, Proverbs 8, because it's mixing all six creation days into one long discourse. However, here's where I get the reference towards creation day 3 in the flood. In verse 29, verse 28, when he established the clouds above and fixed security the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters could not overstep his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. And then a final place you can go would be the New Testament, which is 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5. They deliberately forgot that long ago by God's word the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and with water. By water also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. And the reference there in the Greek is tote kosmos, and it means the world at the time the event took place. So the fact that Peter is qualifying what kind of world we're talking about means it's not the same world as today. The world was different before. This is a special circumstance, and it's not referring to the entire planet, but the world that existed at the time for the people at that time. Now, decades ago, there were Bible scholars who looked at this and tried to fit this in with the then popular gap theory. That there was this creation that God had performed, and then God allowed Satan to take his hand at it. Basically, he's doing the same thing he did with Job. You guys think you're so smart? He said to Satan, do you think you're so smart? Well, see what you can do with this creation. And when Job did that, he ruined the creation, and then God had to repair it. So decades ago, there were people who took that perspective but tried to build in that this was a reference, indeed, to the gap theory. But I would argue that doesn't work. because the context is referring to human witnesses of the event. And so this could not be a reference to a gap theory type interpretation. And I just say that because some of you might pick up one of these old commentaries and see that. Modern commentaries don't go there. The gap theory has virtually disappeared in theological exegetical research for a number of reasons. It's really not possible to support the gap theory in the context of Genesis 1 because you have to say the text is saying the world became formless and void rather than the world simply was formless and void. And the problem with that is that the word for the verb there, haya, is haya, it's not hayala. Hayala would be became, haya would be simply was. And so today the gap theory is not popular. But if you do pick up an old commentary, some of them try to build this in to Second Peter, but that's no longer the case in the modern commentaries on this text. And the reason is, as you can see from the verses here, this is clearly referring to human observers. That being the case, it really is referring to the event of Noah, but it's referring to the event of Noah. It's also telling us that it's not our world, it's the world at the time the event took place, and hence we shouldn't be interpreting this as a global flood, but we should be interpreting it as a universal flood. I'm a few minutes over. I'm sorry. It's Father's Day. I need to let you all get home and take care of your fathers. You know, the thing I noticed about Father's Day, most fathers are hoping that their wife and kids and relatives don't give them a gift that's going to really disturb their budget. You know, men, we're responsible for the budget, right? And that always happens. Says, oh no, when did you buy me? So somebody says, we shouldn't be calling this Father's Day. But I get to do a dinner for my father-in-law. And that's going to be fun. Yes. Sure. Yeah, no, it's a very good thought. In fact, that was part of my conversion experience, was reading this book and realizing that it predicted Big Bang cosmology thousands of years before Einstein discovered it. So that's something you'll see in our book, The Creator and the Cosmos, the latest edition. And I really thank John Ray, a theologian, for showing me just how well that is taught in the scriptures. Right. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Now that's a Father's Day gift. All right, Father in Heaven, we thank you for a day and we get to honor our fathers. And Lord, may it really reflect upon you as our Father. Lord, so I pray that as families get together today and the families and members here in the class, this would be a day that would really be honoring to you. Thank you, Lord, for fathering us. Thank you, Lord, for creating this beautiful place in which we can live. And thank you, Lord, that you're not a God that hides from us. You're a Father that's intimate. May we enjoy intimacy with you today. In Jesus' name, amen.